to the American Revolution Podcast, episode 79, Saratoga, the Beginning. So when last I left, which was only 5 minutes ago, I was going over two important things that happened in April and then in July of 1777. First is the raid in Danbury. Emboldens the people of Connecticut. They were attacked and they were had a town burned by British coming in to destroy supplies. And then in July, the murder of Jane McCrae, which also gets the people in and around New York, the future state of Vermont, gets their dander up and gets them ready for a fight as well. But what about the army itself? Gates is going to arrive at the Patriot camp north of Albany at the mouth of the Mohawk on August 19, 1777. There he discovers that his army is no more than 4,500 men, with another brigade posted about 5 miles up the Mohawk. Arnold had not returned from Stanwyck yet. Benjamin Lincoln was on the other side of the river with 500 militia waiting for Burgoyne to come farther south because he was going to attack his rear. John Stark, however, was still north in Bennington, brooding over the fact that he had gotten snubbed on the report from the battle. Stark would delay bringing his men into the American camp until the day before his men's enlistments expired. Then they would be wandering off, so this was not a reliable brigade that was coming into the battle. Arnold, having secured Fort Stanwyck, left 700 men in the garrison and then returned with another 1,200 men in the first week of September. At the same time, some more support had arrived from Washington. It was 300 Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia riflemen under the command of the ever-courageous, ever-badass Colonel Dan Morgan. I like to give my cool American Revolution commanders fun nicknames and highlight their backstories just because, well, let's face it, they're the whole reason that the war is won. You can sit there and say that Benedict Arnold was a bad guy. Maybe so in 1779, but in 1777, dude is crazy. Just reminder, listen to Danbury Raid, the part where he gets shot from under his horse and then shoots at a guy and says, "Not today." Just saying. Dan Morgan, once again, another badass. Let's rewind it back to Quebec. He, unfortunately, is not in the retreat. He gets caught by the British. The British are like, "Hey, man, come out, or we're gonna light you guys up." Dan Morgan says, "Oh, bring it on." He says, "I will not surrender to any of you bastards." And they're like, "Come on, just surrender. It's cool." And he says, "Fine, I see a priest. I'll surrender to that guy because I don't respect any of you clowns." And he does. He surrenders to a priest. I mean, come on. You got to give the man credit. He did not fear the British in any way, shape, or form. These troops were expert shots, backwoodsmen, and they were used to the type of terrain that would you be found in upstate New York. More importantly, they were adept Indian fighters. They carried rifles, which could fire a lead ball accurately up to 300 yards, and these men could do it. The only problem was the rifles could not affix bayonets. So along with these riflemen, Washington sends 250 light infantry under Major Henry Dearborn. These men carried muskets with bayonets like normal Continental soldiers would, except they had spent a lot of time hanging out with Dan Morgan and his boys, and, well, they could fight just as good as the backwoodsmen using their muskets and bayonets as these guys could use their knives and rifles. So Gates has gotten all kinds of support from Washington. He's got Arnold. So he's got himself a decently sized army. While all of this is going on, I want to go back to Dearborn's men. The whole reason Dearborn is with Dan Morgan is because the rifles can't affix bayonets. British war tactics at the time were fire a volley, close distance, fire a volley, close distance, fire a volley, bayonet charge. In the time that it takes a trained soldier to fire three musket shots, it takes about a decent rifleman to fire one, maybe get maybe two shots off. The rifle was a very complex weapon. It was used for hunting. When you're hunting a deer, you only get one shot. So if you miss, it doesn't really matter. You're not going to reload. But in the fight that with soldiers, you're going to have to reload. The thing is that they far outpaced and outranged the standard muskets so that they were very useful in a sniper-type capacity. Problem was, if they got charged by bayonets, they'd have nowhere to go but run away. The light troops were there to protect them. Okay, sorry. Back to Burgoyne we go. Burgoyne has been feeling the repercussions from Bennington and on since that battle ended. Everything that's happened to him has been swift and absolute. The failed expedition deprived the army of the supplies and provisions that they could use to push forward. Instead, they're forced to wait for more supplies coming from the north. So this gave Gates plenty of time to fortify his position. Burgoyne's army waited at camp at Fort Miller, about 4 miles north of Saratoga. Bennington had also cost Burgoyne 800 men, 450 of which were regulars. On top of that, the McRae murder saw stiff restrictions placed on the Indians and their operations by Burgoyne. After the defeat at Bennington, and now the restrictions placed on them, the Indians call a council of war, and they decide to leave. So of the original 500 Indian troops, or Indian scouts, that are with Burgoyne's army, 80 are going to remain. So everything is going wrong for Burgoyne. St. Ledger is not going to be there. He's already found out that Howe has headed south from New York. Clinton is his last best hope, but we're going to see how that goes. So what does Burgoyne have in all of this? Well, first, the force that's meant to strike complete fear at the heart of the Continental Army is gone. Is 80 Indians. That's not going to do it. Okay? 500 was a force to be reckoned with. 80, not so much. He has a fair share of loyalists in the army, about 450 men. That's not bad. The problem is half of them are unarmed. Okay? After Fort Stanwyck, we don't have the support from St. Ledger. Bennington, he loses 800 men, including a good percentage of German soldiers. So everything that happens to Burgoyne after Bennington completely goes against him. Way back when we started this whole thing, Burgoyne felt that he was going to have the support of the Loyalists. The Loyalists were going to rise up, join him in the fight. No, that's not true. Bennington happens, they get their butts handed to them. They get severely beat up. Hubbardton didn't look great. They had the raid on Danbury, the supposed killing of a woman on the, you know, in the Hudson Valley. The Loyalists aren't joining up. It's put too bad a taste in the Patriots in the area. They might as well just, you know, keep themselves quiet and say, nah, I ain't got nothing to do with those British people. Okay? So Burgoyne is in a tough spot. What's he going to do? The fact is that he can't sit idle. Okay? He could move back to Fort Edward and wait for reinforcements, or he could move more men and supplies, let me rephrase. He can go back to Fort Edward, wait for reinforcements, get the supplies he needs, and wait it out. But, once again, waiting is leaving gates open for reinforcements to be sent to him. If he's going to strike, he's going to strike while he can. If he moves to Albany, he can fortify the city. Then maybe he can wait for Clinton and Howe to come north. Realizing that he's besieged in the city, maybe he stands a chance of, or at least a portion of the city, setting himself up, positioning himself in such a way that it forces the Americans to lay siege to him. And if they lay siege to him, it forces other generals elsewhere to march to Burgoyne's aid. So, not a terrible plan, but it's fraught with risk. You know? He is going to go south, and he's going to try and take Albany. Then he's going to wait there for Howe, but it's now August 19th. The army has grown to 7,000 in all. We have Bennett Arnold back from the frontier. We have Dan Morgan's boys, and we're starting to gather more militia. Of these 7,000 men, you have Continentals, militia, and support volunteers. So we know that Burgoyne's not getting the help from the West. He's got a force that is similar, if not a just slightly larger than his own, in front of him. So he has to, you know, Burgoyne has to make a decision. Gates himself was a British officer before the Revolution, and like Washington, saw the opportunity to use his knowledge and skills to lead the American army now. He felt that his position at the mouth of the Mohawk Valley was not conducive to the style of fighting that he would employ against the British. Remember, British soldier, he's going to fight like a British general. I'm sorry. He's a former British officer, and he's going to fight his men like they are British soldiers. That doesn't work for the American style. I mean, Washington did it, and look what happened. I think if you had a large enough force, yes, to stand toe-to-toe with the British, I think it can be done. But for your unwashed masses, your militia, your untrained Continentals, I feel like other tactics could be employed. Gates doesn't do that, and we're going to see how that affects his career in the future. But for now, he's going to try and whip the Northern Army into a fighting force that can take on Burgoyne. So he wants to find himself a bit of open ground, and he would have to look a little farther north. On September 9th, the American army is back in the area of Stillwater. The ground here was open, but it was almost too open. It could allow the British to turn their position. So they're like, well, we got to move somewhere else. So 3 days later, on September 12th, the army would move again, this time 3 miles to the north, at a place where the river runs through a narrow defile that's known as Bemis Heights. This area is named for the owner of a tavern that was near the heights. The heights rose about 200 to 300 feet above the river, giving the army a natural choke point to protect. A man that we are going to talk about quite a bit in future episodes, Polish engineer Thaddeus Kosciuszko, is going to be back with the army building fortifications. Okay, so what happens is they build a fortification at the river to block the river and force the British into this chokehold. They then continue the fortifications on farther. The fortifications are going to run from the river about a mile. When it was laid out, it would resemble a three-sided fortification with the rear would be the only place where they wouldn't have a wall. They had a wall near the river, they had it up on the hills, and then it curved through some farmland to the west of the river. All these fortifications are laid out, and they're getting ready to build their position. They're going to use a redoubt-style position, where they're building a wall with a wood and earth and bundles of sticks, and they do this across the whole way. They also create a depression in front of the wall so that it is difficult for the British to get over it. Inside these entrenchments, they would throw some abatis in front just to make it even worse for the British who were trying to climb the wall. So the defensive position was actually fairly strong. The center of this whole defensive line would be at the Nielsen farm. His house would be the field his house would be the command center for field commanders such as Benedict Arnold and Ebenezer Learned. Gates himself would be headquartered in a small farmhouse not 10 feet square near the rear of these great fortifications. He spends Gates himself spends most of his time in his camp area, and it will be fall to the field commanders who will really garner the glory for the battles of Saratoga, but unfortunately, once again, it's one of those incidences where victors write the history, and, well, if you're that victor and you're the general in charge, you get first dibs at writing how history goes. So they build this mile-long wall. They start at the river and they go westward. The bulk of the work was completed in under a week. Impressive feat. Kosciuszko had these men working hard hours, but he was able to get them to build the fortification in under a week. Quite impressive. Burgoyne would arrive sometime around September 19th, and he was trying to figure out what his plan was as he went downriver and saw the fortifications. And, well, the battle is going to kind of fall into his lap. He knew that he had to get past the American defensive line. How he was going to do it was yet to be seen. The one thing I can tell you is that he's going to find himself in the middle of a battle that he does not want, and he cannot win come this second week or third week of September, I should say. Well, that's going to do it all for now. We are going to dive fully into the Saratoga campaign, and we're going to talk about that first day, that first battle that happens on September 19th next week. Now that I've gotten myself more organized and in a better position with how everything is progressing, I will hopefully be back on track with doing an episode a week. I did these two episodes on top of each other because it has been 4 weeks, but with the baby in the house, that becomes a little hectic. So just stay tuned for the next episode where we're going to look at the first Battle of Saratoga. There are actually three separate battles we are going to talk about. In that time, we're also going to mention what Henry Clinton is doing and during this time and how he's going to try and come to Burgoyne's aid. But, well, that's just not going to work out at all for him. Until next time, I hope everyone had a good day of barbecue, a good Memorial Day, and I will be putting out a new episode next weekend. So everyone have a great week. And, as always, keep the powder dry.